Coming up on Boston Public Radio, between them, they've worked 68 years at Market Basket. Both started at age 14. They were both fired Sunday night. Tom Trainor and Joe Schmidt join us for the latest in their struggle, and they'll take your calls. Then, robot caregivers, not just to do mechanical tasks, but to be a companion. Are you ready for them?
Juliet Kime, the crisis at the borders and the crisis in housing, our own homeless. Then our concert roundtable, the very best new music and the best music around town in jazz, classical, and pop. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. This is hour two of a special three-hour edition of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. You're holding up well, Jim.
I am so far. It's been a tough day, but I think I'm big enough to be able to make it.
That's good.
You know, yesterday, if you read the paper, watch the news, top police officials and activists gathered at the State House for a rally. Joining us on the line to explain what happened on Beacon Hill to draw this concerned crowd is Boston Police Commissioner William Evans. Commissioner, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Having me on, Jim.
Yeah, thank you very much, Commissioner Evans. So it is unusual, as Jim just said. You rarely see a picture of all these police chiefs up there on the steps and Beacon Hill. What was the issue that brought you up there?
Well, it was an issue with the new gun legislation. I think, you know, a couple of weeks ago, the speaker put forward with the House, you know, some new gun legislation, and we were very happy with that. And then when it went to the Senate, you know, we had certain language that we weren't very happy with, because it basically took out a lot of the discretion in the suitability clause, where us as police chiefs, if we know some reasons to deny someone an FID card, which an FID card allows people to purchase shotguns and rifles and have them in their homes. You know, a lot of times we know background information on people that, you know, whether it's they've been involved in domestic incidents or, you know, some mental issues. You know, based on the totality of circumstances, sometimes we can say denied. And if we don't get this legislation in, then, you know, people can go down and we have no say in them getting an FID card. So I think it's an important public safety issue, especially here in the city, where we're continually, myself and Mayor Walsh, trying to fight the flow of guns into the city of Boston.
So we're talking to Boston Police Commissioner William Evans. So the deal is now that police chiefs around the Commonwealth can say no to an FID card for a handgun, and you wanted that to extend to saying no for shotguns and rifles, and the Senate has denied you that.
Yeah, right now, you know, they took out the suitability, and we always had that. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, and I remember being a captain once when a mother called me and informed me that her son, who had some issues, was going down to apply for a license to either carry a firearm or an FID card. And she asked me to try to stop that. And I remember doing that. So, you know, so we have access. A lot of people do not have criminal records, obviously, but there's other issues going on in their lives that
right.
we're aware of. And based on the knowledge we have, I think we should be able to determine the suitability of who should possess a gun, especially here in the city, Marjorie, where you know that's been our number one priority, to basically take as many guns off the street as well as make sure the right people possess them.
Yeah, just so I'm clear, Commissioner Evans, I had to read the Globe story twice because I was a little incredulous that this could have happened. And by the way, the vote was 28 to 10. It was overwhelming in a democratically controlled state Senate. So essentially, you were just looking, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, for the exact same power as a police chief over rifles and shotguns that you already have over handguns. Is that not right? You're not asking for anything extraordinary, just that same right extended to those kinds of weapons. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what's the, what was the argument? What is, when you talk to individual legislators, what is that? I mean, we read one guy said this, Senator Timmelty, who's chair of the key committee, said he was worried it violated the Constitution. Well, I'm not much of a lawyer, but I would argue if what you wanted violates the Constitution, so does the provision about handguns. So he can't have one and not have the other. What's the real reason? Did they cave to the NRA or Gun Owners Action League? What's going on here?
Yeah, I don't really understand, Jim. I don't really want to get into the politics of what might have happened. All I know is, you know, every day our officers are doing a great job to try to make the city safe and to get as many guns off the street. So far this year, you know, we've taken, 59 shotguns and rifles that have been illegally possessed off the street. We've taken about 730 handguns off the street. So I just know, not having that suitability and just handing out guns to anyone who maybe doesn't have a criminal record is not the answer. So I don't know why this legislation is different, but quite frankly, I know there's a lot of great people on the Senate. You know, I just hope they reconsider, and especially for issues such as me and Walsh, Mayor Walsh takes so seriously, and that's stopping people getting guns that don't deserve to have them.
We're talking with Boston Police Commissioner Evans. You know, one of the things, I suspect, and you would know better than I do, Commissioner, this isn't so much of a big deal in the bigger cities like the Bostons and the Springfields and the Worcesters, but you hear this a lot in the suburbs and the smaller towns, and it's exactly what Jim Wallace, who runs the Gun Owners Action League, complained about, that police chiefs in smaller towns abuse their power by not giving licenses for handguns to people who deserve them. He says that's a legitimate criticism.
Yeah, it could be true in a small town, but there has to be restrictions because, people should have a legitimate reason for possessing them. And my problem here in the city is quite frequently we might have a house break and a legitimate person who possesses them has them stolen, and then they go out into the hands of people who are going to use them for the wrong reason. So, based on what we do here, we screen everyone to make sure, they haven't been involved in where they have a 209 restraining order against their stuff like that. And, I know people like to hunt and I know people like to use them in sport, but, in the wrong hands, these guns can go out. And we've seen that. And when I was on your show, I talked about the impact of seeing that 9-year-old in Mattapan shot by a gun that was laying around the house by his 14-year-old brother. Yeah. And that's the type of stuff myself and Mayor Walsh are trying to prevent by having guns in homes, just hanging around where they can get into the wrong hands.
You know, you mentioned hunting and recreation, that sort of thing. We're talking to Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans. Stan Rosenberg, who is a state senator from Western Massachusetts, he will be the new Senate president as soon as the term ends. Terry Murray is stepping down, or I guess she's term limited or something. Here's a quote in the Globe from Senator Rosenberg. A lot of members, meaning of the 28th, who voted against what you wanted, Commissioner Evans, a lot of members felt since the focus of that was on long guns, which is basically what people use for recreation and sport, there were sufficient controls through the federal criteria, and therefore it was not necessary. How do you respond to what Rosenberg said, Commissioner?
Well, I don't agree with that, Jim. I mean, having long guns and rifles and shotguns, especially here in the city of Boston, I think we should have, as the local authority, some say in the matter. And, the federal doesn't really allow us to have the discretion that we want in these particular cases. So, like I said before, we've had 59 already shotguns and rifles taken off people who have possessed them illegally, Jim. And I just hate to see where we make it easier for more people to get access to these weapons in the city of Boston, because for the most part, nobody in the city needs a shotgun. Nobody needs a rifle. And I don't know a lot of people who are into hunting, who being a lifelong resident, would actually want that, who lives in the city. But especially in the city, I want to have discretion over who's getting any type of gun, because public safety is my main concern. And as you know, it's an uphill battle taking as many guns off the street right now without pumping more into the system.
You know, one of your colleagues from Wellesley, and you know, it's not exactly a crime capital out there, Terry Cunningham, is a police chief, is quoted in the Globe. He was part of your event yesterday morning. Are people really going to be any less dead if they're killed with a rifle or a shotgun than a handgun? And I'd say that sort of sums it up. A couple of last things, Commissioner Evans. Obviously, this is an issue that matters a lot to people who do what you do for a living. Do legislators who are in, who represent, for example, Boston, or in the case of Wellesley, whoever represents Wellesley in the Senate, do they reach out to the police chiefs prior to this vote and say, we'd like your input? Or essentially, were they voting on this and then you guys heard about the turn that troubled you and you rushed up to Beacon Hill with John Rosenthal, who we know from the handgun organization? Is that what happened? Did they reach out to you, or you just responded to what you heard was happening there?
Well, in this particular, I think probably, you know, most of my legislators living in the city, Jim, were very much on board.
With
they realize the violence and the efforts we are combining. I can't speak for the other chiefs and the legislators, but I know, you know, all of us here in the city are very concerned about handgun violence and the need to get them off. So I've always had the support of the delegation, the Boston delegation here. But the problem is, I think, as you know, gun violence impacts, and you mentioned earlier, the major cities, whether it's the Springfield, the Brockton. So we obviously have a lot more at stake to make sure that the suitability clause is put back in. And, you know, I hope both the Senate, who I have the utmost respect for, in the House can work together to get that language back in there.
And by the way, we should say that. So this is not just a sorry tale to finish the thought that Commissioner Evans had. This now goes to a conference committee. The
yes.
House version includes the provision that the police chiefs, including Evans, wants. The Senate version does not. Six of the senators who voted to remove the provision that Commissioner Evans and the others want have already proposed new language. So if you care about this issue, call your legislator, whether he or she is a senator or a state rep, and tell them what you think, and you have a decent ability to affect the ultimate outcome here.
Commissioner Evans, as you were speaking about hunters, you know, maybe it's a gross generalization, but when I think of people who like to hunt, I think of them in the rural areas. I mean, I don't know that many people who live in the Back Bay or Dorchester or even Jamaica Plain that are hunting on the weekends. I don't know. Maybe I'm hanging around with the wrong crowd. Do you know many locals that are big into hunting, Commissioner Evans? Maybe you do.
No, you know, I'm a lifelong South Boston resident. And,
yeah.
Oh, I'm not a big gun nut myself, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
You know, and we grew up and, you know, and I didn't know a lot of people, to tell you the truth, who did it. So I think this is not so much a city issue.
Yeah.
Why I say, I don't know many people who want to go out and buy a shotgun. I never knew anyone growing up with and wanted rifles in their home. So that's why it's so important, at least in the city, to stop these guns from being in people's closets.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, you know, sometimes these guns end up in the wrong hands. A child can get them. And so, you know, this is a very important issue for me and the mayor. And again, you know, knock on wood, and I hate to jinx this, we've had a pretty good summer with the violence after having a rough start in January and February, and we hope to continue attacking the gun issue and bringing down the violence so we don't have any more kids shot in the city this year.
Commissioner Evans, so do we. Thanks for sharing the message with us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Marjorie and Jim.
Thank you very much. That was the voice of Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans. Okay, coming up, we're turning our attention to another rally that was 3,000 people strong. We're talking about the protest on Monday where folks rallied to have ousted Market Basket CEO Arthur D. T. DeMoulas, because the other guy is Arthur S. Arthur T. DeMoulas reinstated as head of the grocery enterprise. Two employees who put their jobs on the line. Join us next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie in a special three-hour edition today. On Monday, thousands of protesters, I'm sure you saw, rallied on behalf of Market Basket's ousted CEO, Arthur T. DeMoulas. And it wasn't sheer theatrics. Jobs were online, jobs were lost. Here with us in Studio 3 are two men who gave up their careers. They were fired on Sunday so that their former employer could resume his. Tom Traynor, 41 years at Market Basket. Tom, it's good to see you again. Thanks for coming.
Nice to see you.
Joe Schmidt, a mere 27 years at Market Basket. Joe, it's good to see you, too. Thank you, gentlemen.
Good to be with you today. Thank you.
Thank you both for coming in. Well, I saw you both on WGBH, at least I saw you on WGBH, Joe, and I saw you both together with Jim on NECN. And I know you began working there at Market Basket as very young men. Let's start with you, Tom. What was your deal?
I started at 14. Jim didn't believe that the other night.
I still don't believe it. 14.
And the Chelmsford, Mass store is a bagger.
And you've worked there your whole career.
That's it. The only job I've ever had. 41
years. The only job
years.
You've ever had. And how about you, Joe?
Yeah, same story. You know, I started as 14 years of age in our Danvers store. And, you know, quickly learned that this company was someplace special. And, you know, there have been a lot of people that have kind of set the path and for all of us. And it was very easy to get into that, get going into the system there and growing into the company and working our way up through it.
How is it special, Joe, to use your word? How is Market Basket a special place to work?
It's a team of loyal employees. It always has been. You know, it's more than just doing the job, punching the clock. It's about relationships and mentorships and that type of thing. And that's really what makes that company so special.
Was your expectation that you, again, 27 years, you started 14 too. Was your expectation your whole career was going to be spent at Market Basket, Joe Schmidt?
Oh, without question. You know,
and you too, Tom Traynor.
No.
41 years.
When I was in high school, I can't tell you that I thought it was going to be the job that I would never leave, but, you know, the company bites you, and, you know, you get into it, and you love it, and you love the business. It's a tough business, but if you love it, you have a passion for it, it's a great business to be in.
By the way, Tom Traynor and Joe Schmidt are happy to take your phone calls. Our number is 877-301-8970. If you want to talk about your experiences at Market Basket, want to support them, want to criticize them, want to ask them questions, they're here, 877-301-8970.
One of the things that we've read about and heard about from employees this week is it you can earn a decent living at Market Basket, and you guys have been there your whole lives, and you've got families, I assume, and to support and stuff. So that's a big deal, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the company is, it's like I said, loyalty, two-way street. You know, you put into it and you get out of
yep.
it. And this is a place where, you know, very easily someone can support their family. And that's what the company has always been about, is the culture of loyalty, the culture of taking care of families, you know, not just employees, but also customers.
Yep.
And that's why our company has been so special.
So what do you think is going to happen now? There was a meeting yesterday Monday with the board of directors. Do we know what they did on Monday?
No, it was supposed to be a telephone meeting, and I'm not even sure if it took place.
And there's another one on Friday, which is more...
That's a regularly scheduled board meeting.
Are you guys
Friday.
Allowed to go? Are
no.
employees, former
no.
employees allowed to go? No,
no,
it's a closed meeting? Okay.
And so, you know, I've, like most people, have been so inspired by this. I've never seen it happen before where the employees go rally the boss that got fired. I mean, I've had bosses fired, and my dad wasn't rallying. I wasn't out there.
It's top down, too, Marjorie. It's from senior management
yeah.
down to the part-time line workers. It's everybody's galvanized together.
But it almost seems to me, and maybe I'm too cynical or not hopeful enough, that it's going to take a miracle for a board of directors to totally turn 180, get rid of the people that they've hired, and then bring back Arthur T. Demoulas. Am I being...
Well, maybe we are naive, and maybe that we're naive enough to think that we can win this. But what was the reason they fired him? I mean, the profits were up. We were growing. Volume was up.
Yep.
You know? What was the reason they fired him?
Well, what do you think the reason they fired him is?
I think it was Arthur S. DeMoulas's vengeance.
The family thing, which
yeah,
we've seen in a number
of... nothing to do with his business decisions.
You know, I want to follow up on what Joe said a minute ago. For those, and these guys have been representing their colleagues a lot lately. When you guys were on my show, then I was inundated with letters like this one. This is totally typical. I don't want to read the woman's last name because I didn't ask her approval. Lisa from Barrington, New Hampshire. I've shopped at Market Basket for 20 years. Low prices got me there originally, but when our son was 15, he got a part-time job bagging and ringing groceries. He resigned just last year after 10 years of service. He was 25, had obtained a doctorate degree. Our son worked at three different locations based on where he was going to school. He was able to dictate his hours. He was paid time and a half Sundays and holidays, given a generous scholarship for 6 years, Marjorie, through graduate school. He took 10 leaves of absence, some as long as 2 to 3 years, and even got bonuses when he got back from... And this is the typical kind of letter. So what's the deal with, I was going to say Demoulas, but there are a few of them. What's the Arthur T. thing? What drives, I mean, a lot of people are good to their workers because they think it's good business. Is there more than that? I mean, what is this? I've never met him. What kind of guy is Arthur T. Demoulas to have these kinds of policies in place, Joe Schmidt?
A man of great integrity, a man that his actions speak volumes. You know, everybody has looked up to him as well as the other members of the company. And again, I come back to that team mentality and the culture. The culture is very important here. You know, the culture of loyalty, which is shifting to the culture of fear. And that's, in essence, what this story is transpiring into. And that's why you see the employees standing up for what they believe in.
Right.
There really is no other way to do it. And the customers are also getting involved in that because they understand what the company's all about.
Well, when I was in Chelsea on Friday, you know, some of the employees were telling me things that how Arthur would come into the store and say, what do you think about the deli? You know, how's it running? Or what do you think about soliciting opinions from people that were, you know, not entry-level jobs, but they weren't obviously up in management. And that was a big thing.
And he probably called them by name. And he
yes.
probably asked them how their son was. Or,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing that they talked about is that a fear that what's going to happen here, besides the vengeance thing between Arthur T. and Arthur S., is that the shareholders want more money out of the company.
Lies
so that,
and liquidity. That's
yeah.
what this is all about. Lies and liquidity.
You think their ultimate gold top trainer is to sell the company?
I think they lie, and I think their goal is to sell the company, and short of that, to sell the real estate, which will completely change the business model.
Before we get to the calls, and the lines filled up literally in about 10 seconds wanting to talk to you, too, just to be clear, one, you don't, because you were fired, I assume you don't qualify for unemployment benefits, correct?
Haven't checked yet.
I haven't checked. Do you think, I had a lawyer on my show last night who thinks you may, under the personnel manual, have some legal rights to contest this. You're not doing that either, are you, as of the moment, Tom Traynor or Joe Schmidt? Are you doing anything about your own employment
we're
situation?
Just doing media right now.
No, but yeah. I'm serious. You're not getting unemployment, correct?
We haven't filed yet. We haven't tried to file. I don't know if I'm eligible or not. Quite honestly.
Yeah, I think we need to look at that option.
Yeah, why would you not? Arguing you were inappropriately fired. And do you think you're inappropriate? I don't mean that was the wrong thing to do, but you examined at all whether or not you were legally properly fired?
Both Joe and I were on vacation legitimately.
Uh-huh.
It was the end of my first week, and a Sunday night, the guy comes up, drives up the driveway with my wife and my youngest daughter sitting there and hands me an unsealed envelope with my termination papers. No reason. I found out the next day they thought I was being disruptive, but
they put out a statement to talk about the co-CEOs.
Right.
You know, you mentioned to me, Tom Traynor, one last thing before we get to take your calls. I said, you know, would you ever have imagined this happening? And you said when you thought you saw some troubles coming, you sat down with your whole family, talked about the options. They were supportive of you. It's one thing to be supportive in the abstract before it happens. It's now been, what is this? It's 3 days or whatever it is, 4 days. There's no sign, even though you have huge public support, that you're getting your job back anytime soon. Is the family still supportive?
My wife filed for divorce the other day. No, no. No,
my wife,
Barbara, is a wonderful woman, and she's been supportive the 32 years I've been married to her. And my kids, I mean, I showed you a letter this morning from my son's a lieutenant JG in the Coast Guard.
Really?
Out in San Diego, and he wrote a letter, sent a copy to me, to the board, and to the co-CEOs.
To the board and the CEOs. Yeah.
Saying what?
Basically how mad he was at what they did to his father.
Are you getting the same sort of support, Joe Schmidt? Families, friends, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. The support level has actually increased, and the outpouring has been overwhelming for me personally.
Aren't you worried about how you're going to pay the bills?
You know, I know who I am. I know what I stand for. I know that I'll be a valuable asset to a company. I'll land on my feet. I'll be okay. As I stated before, it's important to take a stand for something you believe in and to be able to look your family in the eye and say, hey, this was the right thing to do.
I wish you could see Marjorie's face, people listening at home, as Joe is speaking about taking a stand.
Braver men than I am. I mean, I admire you tremendously for doing it.
We were just talking about this in the green room.
Yeah.
And both of us said, you know, I know no matter what the outcome is here, I can look Arthur T. Demoulas in the face and know that everything I've done, there wasn't anything more I could do for him.
And by the way, there have been you told me there are no communications with him. It's not being orchestrated by Arthur T. or any of his people.
Nothing.
This is just independent. That's correct, both of you guys.
Yes.
Right?
I keep saying one last thing before we get to the calls, but this is the last thing for me anyway before we get to the calls. We have not heard that much from Arthur T. Demoulas. He has said reinstate the people who were fired, but why do you think he hasn't come out more?
He is most comfortable walking around amongst his employees, mm-hmm. associates, and his customers, and I'm sure he would want to be at those rallies. It's probably killing him that he couldn't be. My guess, and I don't know, I can only speculate, is there some legal reason why he can't.
Okay. Is that what you think, Joe?
Yeah, I believe that would be okay. the case.
Okay, let's take some calls.
Is 877-301-8970. We are in studio with two longtime employees of Market Basket who are no longer employees of Market Basket, at least right now. Let's go to Catherine from Somerville. Thank you for calling, Catherine.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I am a longtime Somerville, the shopper at the Somerville Market Basket.
And thank you.
From my, you just can't compare the quality, the price, the friendliness, everything. And I think for those of us that shop there regularly, we're worried because it'd make a big difference in my monthly food budget if I have to go shop somewhere else. And what you're saying about that they want to, what is it, lies and liquidate or whatever it is, that's a really scary prospect of having to, spend $2.50 a pound for apples instead of 99 cents a pound for apples.
Hey, Catherine, thank you for your call. Tom, do you worry that the ultimate outcome, I know this is not what you're working for, the ultimate outcome is Arthur T. DeMullis does not get his job back. Mm-hmm. You're successful in urging a boycott as you have. People are forced to go to other supermarkets. Then the end game is Market Basket implodes and DeMullis doesn't get his job back. And you guys are, do you worry about that, that the demise of the whole thing and the customer base goes elsewhere?
Well, I think that would be the board's problem, They see what's happening, or they have to see what's happening, and if they don't react to it, to me, that's negligence. They have a fiduciary responsibility, and ultimately, they'll pay the price for that.
There's a great picture on the front page of the Globe today of Market Basket customers taping their receipts from purchases they made at Stop and Shop or Shaw's. They painted, stuck them to the window at the Lowell store. We also have an email from Andrea and David, who wrote a letter to the board members and CEOs telling them how they'd shopped at Market Basket, Newburyport, Epping, and Plastow for 13 years, and they want the Arthur T. support, and they want the support for all the employees who are courteous, helpful, and seem to genuinely like their jobs. So thank you for that email, Andrea and David. Let's take a call from Buck, who's on the road. Hi, Buck.
Hey, Buck.
Hi. I just want to say that my car has 430,000 miles on it, which is illustrative of my traveling. And I think I've been to every Market Basket there is, and I deliberately go there because I eat on the road and I get so many good items. And like was just mentioned, the prices are phenomenal, the atmosphere. And by the way, socially, I met Tom Gordon. What a fantastic guy. And he volunteered when I met him about Arthur. And he's been there for forever, too.
Was he fired as well? Gordon was fired as well.
Tom Gordon was my colleague. We split the chain in half, and we were both district supervisors. I had half the company, and Tom has the other half.
I'm sorry, Buck.
What happened to him?
He was fired Sunday night as well.
Oh, what a great guy. There was a specialty item that I wanted. And I can go to the Gloucester, where we live in Gloucester, and get that specialty item that he arranged for me. I mean, this is a great company, and it's a travesty if this doesn't get worked out. And I applaud you men for being of high character. And just thank you very much. And I hope it
works
out.
Thank you,
Buck. Thanks for the call.
Those two men that the caller just referred to, Tom Traynor and Joe Schmidt, they were longtime employees of Market Basket. They're here in studio with us. Joe from Lowell, you are on the line. Thanks for calling, Joe.
Hello, Joe.
Hi. This is, I worked for Tom Traynor for many years. He's just one of the best guys. The one thing about Market Basket is that they teach leadership. They teach self-leadership, I'm getting caught up in my words because I'm so proud to be part of this. I don't work for the company, but I'm a vendor for the company, and just to see the response from the consumers, I'm in front of Market Basket number 2 on Bridge Street right now, and people are beeping. The store employees are invigorated. It's just a pleasure to see this, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Hey, Joe, before you go away, how was Tom as a supervisor when you were a teen?
Awesome. if I can say one thing,
sure.
A funny story. Up in his office, he used to keep a pacifier stuck to the wall, and that pacifier was for the people who came in whining about silly little things that had nothing to do with business. And what he would do, he would offer that pacifier up, and
he's smiling.
True story, Joe.
Hey, Joe, thank you for the call. Hey, Jim, did you ever imagine when you guys decided we're going to take this on? Beyond, I assume, based on my conversation, you thought there was a likelihood you'd get fired. Did you ever in your wildest dreams think public support was going to be anywhere near what it's been, at least through the first week or so of this thing?
I think there was a definite inkling of it.
You really thought this was going to happen?
I think this is a grander scale than we had hoped for, though. I think we had a lot of loyal customers, but you know, people have to eat and they have to shop, and it seems to be right across the board. You know,
how do you manage to get prices so low? I mean, I looked at this really expensive bread that I love. It's a splurge. Pig's Fly bread. I think it's $4.49 at Whole Foods, and it's $4.49 at Market Basket.
You said five something at Whole Foods and four something.
Yeah, like almost a dollar difference. How do you do that?
Well, it's a business model, and the business model is what they're trying to destroy. So you've got a company with no debt, so there's no interest payment.
Yeah.
Okay, so that helps. You have a company that owns the real estate of most of their plazas, which we're hearing they want to sell the real estate. So we're collecting rent, not paying rent. If they sell the real estate, now we pay rent. You have to raise your prices to make that difference up. But he truly passes on the savings of everything he saves on to his consumers.
We have a question via email from Kevin about the business model. He wants to know if current management has made documented changes to management or prices directly in contrast to Arthur T. At this point, what we in the public know is hearsay. We don't know if there have been actual changes happening. Now, that's obviously
well,
one you
first,
just mentioned
the,
was the...
Well, the first change is they walked in on June 23rd, and they're from on the outside, and we don't play well with people from outside the sandbox.
Yeah.
You know, So that's the first change. Our culture is we promote from within. And here they take off the top of the company and they put these two outsiders in who know nothing about our business or our culture.
Okay. Anything else that they've done concretely, Joe, that you can think of?
Well, they had a manager's meeting. And at that manager's meeting, they made multiple statements about how nothing was going to change. Everything will be the same. And our people in our company... They're smart. They sense that, you know, the story that was being told wasn't accurate, and it's starting to show now that you know, the words that they said, we're going to keep everything the same, we're going to keep the culture intact, we're going to keep the philosophy moving forward, and then they take actions against employees such as sending envelopes to their house rather than telling them in person, you know, and subsequently another envelope came today.
Or even a
phone call. Another envelope came today saying what?
Yeah, that was the envelope that informed me that my health benefit would be running out at the end of the month, and that came from our benefits manager at the office there, and it's just very impersonal, you know, and it becomes a personal thing.
Caroline in Worcester, you have a question that we should have asked, so why don't you ask it? Caroline, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi. I can't tell you how I admire these guys. I'm a union person, but God bless you. I want to know, where do I send money so you guys can keep this up?
That's a great question.
You know what? There's actually a website that we set up this morning. Joe, what the heck was it?
He has no. You know what we're going to do? Caroline, in the next... set a time. We're going to have one of our colleagues look for it. If worse comes to worse, if you keep listening, right after the break, after we bid these guys farewell, they'll check it out and we'll tell you what the website is. And if you want to contribute to the cause, I'm sure that they will.
Okay, and
encourage
let me say again, if everyone's rooting for you, if there is a God in heaven, you'll prevail.
Thanks for the support.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Tom Traynor and Joe Schmidt, former Market Basket employees who were fired. These guys have been there for decades, were fired in this dispute over the change in the board that took away the CEO position of Arthur T. Demoulas, a beloved boss. Let's go to Karen from Milford, New Hampshire. Hi, Karen.
Hey, Karen.
How are you?
Great.
I just wanted to say that you guys are great, and I hope you win. But
thank
my
you.
Question was this. Is there any chance, and I don't know the legalities, but is there any chance that maybe Arthur T. could buy him out or open his own supermarkets under a different name, maybe under the Demoulas name or something?
We're sure that if there's anything that Arthur T. can do, he's trying to do it. You know, we have that much faith in the man.
You know, and I think that's important. I think that's important, too, is, you know, Arthur T. is certainly a very wealthy man, and he is certainly not going to just, you know, leave any of us. And that is important.
He said that to us.
He
said
what
to you?
I will never. He said that several times over the past year. I will never leave you. He was so happy for the support of his people and so overwhelmed and humbled. He said, I will never leave you. And that man has never lied to me. He's not leaving me.
And what do you think he meant by that?
I don't know what he meant by it, but I believe him.
Well, it's interesting. A friend of mine wrote a letter to the editor of the Globe today supporting you guys, and she said she's been there forever, described what the situation is for her. And she said that she doesn't even call it Market Basket. She's always called it the Mullahs. So it's not – do you know something you're not telling us? Or
absolutely not.
You don't?
Other than our faith in that man.
Have you guys met the cousin?
Karen, thank you for the call, by the way. I'm sorry. Thank
Arthur
you.
Arthur S. Demoulas. I mean, people don't know. They've been in a long time dispute, family business, you know, fighting over how the company was divided up and so forth and so on. Have you ever met the other guy, Arthur S.?
I have never met the man, and I don't think he cares to meet me.
How about you, Tom? Okay. You said yes?
Yeah, when he got out of college, worked for the company for a couple of years in the produce department, and I knew him then.
And?
What?
And they have been
feuding. I guess
feuding.
That answers
I have
my question,
to say.
Tom.
I can't say
okay,
anything.
Fine.
So they've been feuding for like decades now, in and out of court. And there was some dust up at some golf course that I saw a couple of weeks ago in the newspaper. It's been unbelievable.
Our number is 877-301-897. I asked you both a question the other night that I want to ask you again, because many people like me, like Marjorie, who watch this, says this can't be real. These people can't have this sort of commitment and all these kinds of things and being willing to put themselves at risk financially and so many other ways. So I asked both of you if you'd ever had done activist things before in your life. And when I asked you, Tom Trainor, what was your answer?
Absolutely not. I'm very conservative. Yeah,
and I meant to say to you, we're running out of time. You know, conservatives can be activists too.
Yeah.
But the reality is this is when I see you, for example, in a baseball hat, Tom Trainor, at a rally on television, leading the chants. This you've never done like this like in your life before?
No.
And Joe, how about you?
No, the thing that we've done is we've led the people that we work with every day. So it's a natural progression. And
it's just in a parking lot as opposed to
that's
in a building.
That's exactly right.
By the way, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is the reason that this happened is because the power on the board changed to favor Arthur S. Demoulas over Arthur T., that was your former boss.
And one board member switched their vote, right?
One shareholder switched their allegiance,
okay.
Right?
Okay. So did you anticipate this coming, you know, a year ago before this vote was made? I mean, you knew this could happen.
No, we didn't find out about it until after the vote was made,
okay.
Which was Arthur T. had a meeting with all of his senior management at the office, told us, and then the very next day had a meeting at the Indian Ridge Country Club and told all the store managers.
Okay. So this was pretty much a shock.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely.
All right. 877-301-8970 is the number. Let's go to Ron on the road. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
Hey guys, how you doing? I just want to tell you that I solely support you guys, and I think this is great what you're doing. I kind of wish the American people would do this to the government.
That's a good point.
This is exactly what we need. You know, this is just a smaller scale, and this is exactly what we need. And I have a person that I met in Dumoul, in Market Basket, that I think is wonderful. His name is Dick Adams. He runs the whole fleet department.
Dickie in the garage, yeah.
Great
yeah,
guy.
How did he fare?
Dickie's still there, as far as I know. I mean, I don't know if he's got anything to work on.
But he was a huge supporter. I used to clean all your fuel tanks and generator tanks and stuff at the previous company I worked for. So I used to work with him a lot. And he had unbelievable things to say about the company and Arthur. And he, you know, as you know, he's pretty. He tells it like it is.
Loose cannon.
Yes. And he's great, and, you know, I've developed a pretty good relationship with him, and he's spoke so highly of the company and everybody that worked for it. And I can tell you, I'm from Milford, New Hampshire also, just like Karen, and all the stores, I live in Ware, but all the stores in the surrounding area are completely bare. My wife went in yesterday to grab some essentials because she's so used to it. We always shop at Market Basket. And she walked in, and she was like, it was like Armageddon. There's nothing in there, and she actually turned around and walked out. And every person that she talked to that was protesting was still extremely nice to her, courtesy, and thanked her for coming back to the store.
Ron,
I can't say anything more than that.
Ron, thank you.
Thank you.
You said it well. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Joe, what's the strategy? I mean, I asked you both the other day, is there any end game that would satisfy you other than the rehiring, the putting Arthur T. back in as CEO? You both said, no, that's what this is about. But what's the strategy? Is it just the same thing every day? Continued boycotts? Well, obviously the boycott is going to happen because there's nothing to buy in most places anymore. Continued demonstrations. What's the strategy?
Continue to move forward. The customers, it's in their hands. And, you know, the support that they have shown for our entire company, or the entire company of Market Basket, as I'm no longer there, has been just phenomenal. And we're so thankful for it. We really are. And you know, the customers have shown that they're just as loyal to Market Basket as the dedicated associates are.
Is there a place where people can go, I mean, to marketbasket.com or some website that people can go to show their support? We're going to find out about the fund for the employees as well, but a place that, you know, to cheerlead you guys on?
Well, there's a Facebook page, Save Market Basket.
Okay, Facebook page,
There's
Save
also
Market
a
Basket.
Website, wearemarketbasket.com.
Okay. Okay, so those are places they can go.
And we will get you, in short order, the site that Tom was talking about a few minutes ago if you want to support the workers here who obviously are suffering through a pretty tough time.
This isn't for us. This is for the warehouse workers and the truck drivers that have been off the job for the last – since Friday. So, you know.
Okay, let's take a few more for Tom Trainer and Joe Schmidt. They, between them, worked 68 years for Market Basket, both starting at age 14, which I'm still shaking my head about.
Leslie from Whitman. Hi, Leslie.
Hey there. Hey, Leslie.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I merely wanted to say I support you guys 110%.
Thank you.
I do not understand. You're very welcome. I appreciate your support of the workers. As a customer, I can't even tell you what they're thinking, because if this continues, there will be no Market Basket for anybody.
Correct.
And there is a serious customer base that depends on Market Basket, because your pricing is the way it is, and the stores are the way they are, and the staff is the way they are. It just doesn't make any sense what they're doing.
Leslie, thank you.
They're not thinking about the company at all.
Well said.
Leslie, thanks. We want to be clear also, even though I think if you listen to our show last week, it's pretty clear where Marjorie and my sympathies lie in this, both on television at New England Cable News and here. We have invited the CEOs to join us at any time. They have obviously chosen not to. We haven't even gotten a response. We are not screening out negative calls. Every single call is like the one you heard. Every email is like the one you heard. So we're trying to be fair here, but we can't produce another side if the other side isn't willing to speak for itself. Let's take one more before we let you guys go. Elizabeth, you're in Milton. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, Tom Trainer, and Joe Schmidt. Hey there, Elizabeth.
Hey, Joe Schmidt, it's your sister-in-law.
Oh, my goodness.
Hi, Elizabeth. That's not fair.
Now there's
sure
support. Now there's support.
Okay, are you with him or are you against him, Elizabeth? Go ahead.
I have been with Joe since the beginning. This is not new. This is not strange for Joe Schmidt. This is who he is. This is not like this support for Arthur. He didn't need a catastrophe to show his support. He's been like this since I've known.
By the way, his face is all red, I want you to know.
Wow.
You produced that effect in your brother-in-law right in the studio.
We love it. So, I hear people calling in and saying, how can we help you guys? Now, I don't want to stop that, clearly, but Joe's not going to accept any help. Joe's the most independent, self-sufficient guy you've ever met, and I believe in him 100%. We all do over here.
Why wouldn't he give me
right
gas
now.
Money, though?
We'll take care of Joe. We got Joe covered.
Elizabeth, thank you for your sister-in-law-ly phone call. Any final thoughts from either of you guys? Again, we'll get the site where people can contribute to the lower-wage colleagues of yours who are obviously having problems. Anything we need to know that we haven't gotten into, gentlemen, or no?
We're going to have a rally in the Tewksbury Market Basket Plaza on Friday morning at 9 o'clock. The same place as the one that was held Monday, because there's a board meeting Monday afternoon.
Is the board meeting in Tewksbury?
No, I believe they have it at the Pru.
It's Pru.
Some attorney's office.
Okay.
But, big shock, that is.
And
high
Joe,
up, high
any
up
other relatives
Pru.
That you want to talk to? Or is that Elizabeth sort of covered?
You know what, Elizabeth, I love you. Thank you for the call. And but it's, you know, Elizabeth is family, but we're all family. Everybody, all 25,000 of us, you know, we're together. And our customers, too, they're included. And I just want to, you know, we want to thank everybody for
the support. Where are you buying your groceries now, you two?
We're not allowed on property, so
we
can't go to our own stores, so you know, I don't know. We haven't come across that bridge
which
yet
is
in my house.
Which
but,
is ridiculous, yeah. too. The amount of years we put in to told
that's
that we can't go
point.
Into a store.
Is that part of the thing?
That's
you're not
the,
only fired, you're not allowed
right,
to be
no,
on the property
gotta,
after
no,
68 years between you?
No trespass. We got a no trespass letter.
You know, one last thing before you guys go.
It's unbelievable.
I cannot imagine a worse public relations job in my life than this side is doing. To come down, to hand someone a piece of paper at the end of the driveway to tell you you can't go back. I mean, clearly, if this is how they think they should manage a crisis, well, they can't run anything.
That's who they are.
They released a statement yesterday, and they told the associates, it was kind of in response to Arthur T's statement the other day, and it was about trust and acceptance. And, you know, we can make promises, but it's our actions are going to speak louder than our words. Well, what have their actions proved so far?
Well, speaking of actions, by the way, we don't have time today. In the next couple of days, we're going to share with our listeners the management history of at least one of your new co-CEOs, which suggests that that particular person historically has been in the wrong business. We'll get to that. Gentlemen, it's great to see you. Lots of luck. We really appreciate your coming in.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you very much for being here, both of you. Tom Traynor was a grocery supervisor at Market Basket for 41 years. Joe Schmidt was a supervisor of operations for 27 years. Thanks again for being here and good luck. Up next, caregiving is going electronic. The future of the nurse robot is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. By the way, we found the website. It's called, if you want to contribute to a workers' fund over there at Market Basket, particularly those who are in need, and we're talking about lower-income workers now, you go to GoFundMe.com, and Tom Traynor says you have to look for the link to the Market Basket people. GoFundMe.com. Earlier in the show, we were talking with medical ethicist Art Kaplan. One of the things we talked about was the future of caregiving, and it looks like that future involves, you ready? Robots. Here's Art Kaplan elaborating on what this could mean, and we're going to take your calls on how you feel about this idea after we hear from Art.
Being a caregiver to a person, let's say with Alzheimer's, is incredibly demanding on the caregiver.
Yeah.
And you want to be loving, and you want to be kind, and you feel like a good family member. And you know this, it's 24/7, and there's plenty of caring to do and toileting, and you're not getting positive feedback because they don't recognize you or they don't remember you all the time, and they're fading away, and it's psychologically awful. Robot doesn't have any of those issues, and the robots that are coming can be expressive, can be emotional, can be supportive. Of course, it's all phony, and it's not real in the conscious sense, but to the person receiving the care, particularly with that kind of a condition, I don't think it matters a lot. We know they get great benefit from pets. You know, having animals around has been shown to be very helpful to lots of people. I think robots, I know you don't want to hear this, they are inevitable. They're just cheaper. They're less burdensome on the as caregivers. They're going to be able to do a very sophisticated set of jobs. Heck, they may be able to lift up people and move them around in ways that your average family member couldn't do. They're not strong enough.
But, yeah, but I don't think we should limit this conversation. Maybe this is the transitional phase.
What do you mean, robot radio?
No, I'm just doing, well, that's coming
that's
too.
Coming too.
You know, about mechanical problems or older people with dementia, Alzheimer's. I mean, we all saw the movie with Joaquin Phoenix falling in love with an operating mm-hmm. system, mm-hmm. Scarlett Johansson. By the way, almost everybody in the audience fell in love with the operating system.
Me, I'm there, yeah.
The notion that they can fill a larger role, because it's sort of like what you said before, if the choice is between X, which is imperfect, or Y, which is no service, I'll choose X, meaning those people that didn't get into residency programs. Same situation here for normal old people who are really lonely or who are really embarrassed to ask a human to help them with a particular thing. It makes me feel weird. I can see people building relationships
Absolutely.
With machines, can't you?
Well, by the way, isn't that the relationship you have to your computer and your television set?
Yep.
They are things that entertain you. I know people who talk to the television set, but you don't have to go that far. But it's a mechanical device that entertains and provides you with a stream of feedback, if you want to put it that way. And the more interactive that machine becomes, we can get used to robots, mechanical assistance, as you say, even for mentally with it folks. Mm-hmm. I think robots are coming in the other direction. They're going to do more cleaning and housekeeping and stuff like that around the house. We're going to see them there too. They're going to walk the dog. Some people have them mowing the lawn now, right? You started to see that. So they're going to be part of our lives, and it doesn't bother me or frighten me that they're going to take on roles in caregiving as well. Part of me says good. Some of that work is just too overwhelming and too physically demanding and too emotionally draining. This will be better. I'm not saying you have to choose it, but I think it's something that people are going to wind up using a lot.
Well, you also think about people who try very hard to keep their elderly relatives at home.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems a lot of elderly people have is they can't sleep. These robots don't need to sleep. I mean, they could be keeping you company in the middle of the night.
They can read to you. Or,
exactly. Right. Take a lot of the burden off the
they
mother.
They can play chess with you. They can do all kinds of
things. Exactly.
You know, they can do many, many things.
Yeah.
One of the things I hear from caregivers, and I'm sure people are out there thinking, I still want to do it myself, but, you know, you want a break, you need some time off, you want to go on a vacation, then what? So here comes the robot, now you can go away for a few days, leave that person in the care of the robot and perhaps a supervisor who comes in just to check, but, you know, you get the relief a little bit from the role. And I'm not saying, I'm not trying to put down the role of family caregiver. It's noble, it's great, it's virtuous, but it's demanding and tough. It's very, very hard. I talked to a lot of folks with a kid who's sick, a lot of folks caring for an elderly family member, and boy, they are
drained.
And I have to say, usually women, not men.
Of course it's women, not men. We knew that would be true, didn't we? Okay, that was the voice of Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. We're going to ask you now, what do you think of this idea of a robot caregiver? Here's the number, 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. If you were taking care of someone right now, would you welcome the relief of a robot? 877-301-8970. I'm there. Yes. You know, I would be a little freaked out about the idea, you know, all of a sudden there's a robot, the sparks coming out of his head, like R2-D2 in the movies or something. But I mean, you think of people that are terminally ill, and we've all gone through it, that, you know, they need to be helped to the shower, they need to be helped to the bathroom, they need to be helped getting dressed, they need to be helped in all these areas. I don't know how much these robots, how sophisticated they could
be. Also, cost is going to be an issue, but ultimately, you made a great point, too, which I hadn't thought about, is many people need 24-7 care,
and
which means you have
sleep.
To hire three people.
Well, that's the other thing, that, you know, friends of mine that have gone through this, you know, their parents, and it's usually their parents, are up in the middle of the night and they're calling them, and then the people that are the caregivers can't sleep.
Or not calling them because they don't want to burden their kids.
Exactly.
Or they don't want to share some intimate thing which is embarrassing to them. And, you know, as we said before, reading to the person. And the notion that in 2014, is creepy as it is in some ways, to think, well, wait a second, a human's going to develop a relationship beyond just a mechanical relationship with a robot. You know, get over it. I mean,
Jim, I mean, we already know that many Americans, millions, are over-involved with their dogs. So, you know.
No, but a dog, I mean, I have to say, that's the one. I mean, Art and you are both saying that. That is dramatically different. We know that people lead happier, healthier lives, particularly if they're sick, mm-hmm. if they've got a pet. But you think the pet actually gets it. We all have a mental block, this notion that a robot. No, you know where I'm going? I mean,
I do know, but you just said it. When you went to see that movie, what was it called about the guy
who
fell in love? Her.
Everybody
was ridiculous as it seems, especially when the guy goes on a vacation to this log cabin out in the middle of the woods in the snow with his computer, I mean, with his voice. But by the end of the movie, even midway through the movie,
you get it
because this voice, and people complain it was exploitation of women, et cetera. Okay, yeah, probably was. But you get why this voice seemed to fulfill all this.
Loneliness becomes connection. I agree.
Exactly.
And also, as Art said on another topic, I can't remember what we were discussing when he was with us in our third hour, 11 o'clock hour today, is obviously the perfect situation is to have an affordable, loving human take care of another human. But if the alternative is between no care or horribly inadequate care or a robot, I'll take the robot. 877-301-8970. You ready for this, or is it just creep you out too much? You can't even deal with it. Let's start with Gretchen. You're in a car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Gretchen.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie.
Oh, hi, Gretchen. How are you?
Hi.
It's so nice to hear
great
your voice.
Great to talk to you.
I'm well. Good to hear you. I'm calling because there's, you know, I really get that there is some work that is really, really taxing, difficult, unrewarding, horrific to do. And I think that some of that work, unfortunately, you know, is involved in caring for folks. But I think to think about being a caregiver and relinquishing that over completely to a robotic system is just very sad.
But how about Gretchen, how about respond to how I posed it a minute ago? Most people have a really hard time finding decent, affordable care. If the alternative is between no care or inadequate care or unaffordable care or a robot, who wouldn't say, I'll take the robot, even if it isn't the preferred choice, right?
I understand, Jim, but I think that sometimes we set up a false dichotomy and we say that, you know, it's the robot or nothing. And I think that we wouldn't accept that 30 years ago.
That's a great point, Kirsten.
Have you ever been in a hospital and you're just feeling like crap, and the nurse comes in, and all she needs to do is touch your arm,
right,
and you feel like, oh, my God, there's a human being that cares about me.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I love my computer. I love my telephone. You guys know that. But it's not the same. I mean, I also feel like to compare it to a pet is rather sad as well. I mean, a pet is a living, breathing human organism. And to sort of denigrate the care of a human being to what a robot can do, I don't know. I mean, I would, as a caregiver, if I were a caregiver, I would want the use of the robot. I certainly would. But I just don't want it to become the standard.
Well, I don't think has to be an all-or-nothing kind of thing, Gretchen. I think that's ideally what you want is sort of a stopgap kind of deal. And the other thing is, nobody wants to go to a nursing home. Nobody plans on going to a nursing home. Well, the reason so many people are in nursing homes is because they require the kind of care, right, the 24/7 care that their family can't give them, and their medical situations are too far advanced. Now, the robot may not be able to come in and do everything for the person, but it might prevent people, or it might enable people to stay in their home longer than they can now because they need 24/7 care. And the other thing that we mentioned,
Gretchen, great call as always. It's great to hear from you. Thanks.
There's an awful lot of people with dementia. I mean, you know.
Well, obviously in those situations,
yeah,
they're not, obviously whatever care you can get.
Exactly. Well, also, I mean, I think that you may not be in the same, when your mind is not the way it would be, it may not be a robot to you. You know what I'm saying?
I do understand.
Okay.
But some of us, by the way, who are not in that situation, I would love being carried from my car in the parking lot to the studio. I mean, tell me you wouldn't love it. Be honest for a second. Would you not love that?
I would love it.
Close your car door. You get picked up by a little robot that transports you to the studio, plop you in your chair.
How big they are. The ones I've seen are kind of little.
Yeah.
They're just little tiny numbers. They're about a foot tall.
We'll fix you up.
Let's go to you can hold them.
You can.
You can put them on your lap, Jim.
You can do that. Let's go to Worcester where Kevin is on Boston Public Radio. Kevin, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I love your show.
Thank you very much.
So, I'm against the having this medical device take care of people. I'm a nurse. I've been a nurse for 12 years, and I think that the human touch, someone to hold your hand, someone to put their hand on your shoulder, that can never be replaced by a machine.
Well, you're right. It can't be replaced by a machine. But you know better, being a nurse, Kevin, particularly when somebody is home after the hospital and they have the visiting nurses come in. And what amount of time can the visiting nurses stay? Not that long, right? And they may come twice a week, or maybe they'll come three times a week. You know, I would hope they've never come to hospitals, but it's the home where I see them having the most use.
Well, also, I think Kevin's point and also Gretchen's point is the human touch,
right,
literally and figuratively, is huge. But Kevin, as a nurse who I'm sure is overwhelmed with work, as I'm guessing you are, like virtually everybody else in your profession, you can't be with a patient. The patient is up and restless. The robot reads a book to the patient to calm them down, their favorite author or whatever. Can't that, as an adjunct, as a supplement to what you do as a human, can't that be of some significant value?
I think it can, as a supplement, but to provide the basic care and that emotional factor, I don't think you'll get that in a computer.
Well, I think you make a good point. Kevin, thank you for the call. I think we can all agree, at least to fill the holes, let's put it that way, to supplement care, human care, this is... And not just mechanical things, not just like, as he said, mowing the lawn, or as Art said, but doing, like, reading a book is a really personal, intimate thing. And I'm sorry to glom on it, but you said it, and I thought it was a terrific idea. It keeps someone company. It keeps them entertained.
But also, and again, everybody knows this in their families, where they have people that are in the caregiving role, and it always winds up falling on one kid. You know, there's five kids in the family, and one kid gets stuck. So that one kid that's in charge, you know, they can't even run down to the 7-Eleven, or they can't run to the gym, or they can't run any place because they're worried about something happen when they're gone and their ingrate brothers and sisters aren't about to help them. That always kills me. You know what always happens?
What's that?
It's one person. Say there's five kids in the family, and one person is taking care of mom or dad for 15 years, sacrificed their whole life.
I know where you're going.
Then mom dies. And then the other four fighting about who gets the house. Exactly. You know, I mean, it always happens. You want to say, isn't that horrible? Happens all the time, Jim.
Let's go to Madeline.
That's why I'm getting a robot.
Let's go to Madeline and leaving everything to the... Let's go to Madeline.
That's
and
right.
Newton,
leaving
next.
Everything to the robot.
Madeline, you're in Newton. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call. Hi.
Thank you. Great topic. I just want to say so that I look forward to going home and seeing the robot and my mom watching Days of Our Lives.
That's right. That's great.
That's a great image, by the way. It's a great cartoon.
How
I
cute.
I can see it. I can see it, by the way. Madeline, thanks for the for the call. Company. And again, I mean, the nurse is totally right. And Gretchen's thought, human touch is an irreplaceable thing. But there were a lot of things we thought.
Well, I was just going to say.
But there were a lot of things we thought were irreplaceable 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. They've been replaced pretty adequately. And my guess is, as appalling as the notion is to some people, it's happening.
Yeah, you're planning on your kids taking care of them. And suddenly your kids are going to move to, who knows, California. Yeah. They're going to move to Paris. Or they're going to have springtime in Beijing or something. And then, you know, you're left with a robot, and you're grateful you are. Let's go to, is it Jeannie in North Attleboro? Hi, Jeannie.
Hello, Jeannie.
Hello. My issue is I'm married to a three-decade-long IT professional, and he spends I don't know how many hours a month maintaining our two PCs, which are both relatively new. So I'm not
great
real
point.
About robots. I am also the widow of a man whose liver failed. He was diagnosed with terminal cancer, but it was only the last week of his life where he needed extensive care. It took every cell in my brain to figure out what to do and how to do it. And I don't know how a robot could have anticipated his needs the way I had to. It was exhausting. I'm very grateful that, and I'm sure he is too, that it only took a week of intimate care of him. I cannot imagine a robot doing what I did for even 10 minutes.
Well, Jeannie, I guess to hearken back to at least what a couple of callers have said, in that week, wouldn't having a robot as your partner doing things that you didn't have to do but did need to be done for your husband so that you could spend time with him directly, wouldn't have that been some sort of relief for you?
Well, taking the parallel of our PCs, it would have taken me at least as much work to program the robot as to do the work myself.
Yeah, well, that is sort of
Jeannie,
the Achilles heel. You do wonder about the robot suddenly, you know, imploding or something right in the middle of the caregiving. We're getting several emails about the piece in the New York Times Sunday Review, which talked about how Japanese robots, they mentioned these Japanese, they're way ahead of us in Japan on this whole thing, and they have ones that look like little baby seals, and they listen and respond to speech, and that's true. They're awful
well
cute.
Obviously these robots that we're talking about are going to be able to respond. I mean, they're going to be responding to speech. You're going to be able to think to a degree.
Jake is emailing. He's mad at me because he said lots of men take care of their parents too, so he's mad at me because I said it. He's got three sisters and he was the one that was living with his parents and taking care of them, so it's not always women. You're right, Jake. It just seems like it's always women. Let's put it that way.
We're going to take one final one. Ryan, you're in Newton, but this one's in New Hampshire. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Ryan.
Hey, good. How are you guys doing?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
Good. I just want to talk about mostly the inevitability of it. I mean, Jim, you touched on it earlier. You said how many different things do we think could not be done by anything other than humans, and suddenly they're replaced by robots. I mean, everything, almost everything, like cash registers, even get the self-checkouts, which I can't stand, but we have them.
Yep.
Just the robots doing the job. And you got to remember that this is inevitable, and we are going to have eventually robots and caregiver, whether it's supplemental or as the actual end-all caregiving. But the main thing I want to hit is the Uncanny Valley, which is a very common video game term. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar.
No, I'm not.
It's the point when a robot becomes too human-like and a human becomes too robot-like. So it's like the very middle is the Uncanny Valley. And in video games, it's getting the character's kind of an emotional response from the player.
Oh.
And they're still human and kind of robotic and a little bit of both.
So what's that called again? Wait, Uncanny Valley, is that what you said?
The Uncanny Valley. Yeah. It's the reason a lot of video games don't simulate sex, because there is that Uncanny Valley where it's kind of creepy because you have these two technological, technological creatures, characters simulating this.
Hey, Ryan. You're
going to have to deal with that at some point.
Thanks for the education. We appreciate your call very much.
You know, think about it. There's a lot of upsides. You know how if you're sick or you broke your ankle or something and you wanted three things from downstairs but you forgot and you only asked for one and you feel bad asking the person to go down again and you forget something else, it's like me when I forget
my
glasses.
Who are you talking about exactly?
In here every day, I have to send people up for myself. Think about that. And you probably wouldn't have fights with your robot. You wouldn't feel guilty
points,
about
Marguerite.
Your robot. So I'm telling you, Jim.
I think there's an investment opportunity for you, Marguerite. No, I'm serious. I think you're on to
something. Absolutely. Up next, it is time for Open Mic with Juliet Kyan. We'll get her take on Sergeant Bo Bergdahl and making homelessness a crime, as well as the logistics of securing the border. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is former Homeland Security official and gubernatorial candidate, Juliet Kyan. Juliet, it's great to see you again.
Thank you for having me again.
Great to see you. So before we get to Massachusetts and the children, the unaccompanied children and teenagers that may be coming here, you're a big Homeland Security person. How concerned should we be about these numbers that are predicted to explode coming across the border into the United States?
I think it's a combination of a number of issues that we see being played out. One is, of course, border enforcement. We can never forget that that's the first line, whether it's the National Guard or it's local law enforcement. The other is working with our South American, Latin American, and, of course, Mexican neighbors to stem the flow of what's essentially a mass migration at this stage. And we've dealt with this before. I mean, whether it's Haitians getting into boats or Mexicans coming across the border, or, of course, now what we're seeing, unaccompanied minors. So that's going to be the short-term fix, is both figuring it out at the root cause, as well as border enforcement. But the long-term fix, and anyone who looks at this rationally rather than with an ideological lens, knows that the long-term fix is comprehensive immigration reform.
Well, so until we have comprehensive immigration reform, and who knows when we're going to have that, is Governor Rick Perry right to have 1,000 National Guard troops down on the border?
Well, so let me just put this in perspective, because I dealt with this all the time. So there is National Guard at the border, and there are Massachusetts National Guard members at the border because they do cooperative agreements, and it's a way that our National Guard can get training. So I don't know if they're still there, but certainly when I was the Homeland Security Advisor. So it's not that much of a surprise. I tend to prefer, as a operational matter, local law enforcement. So we can try to help supplement local law enforcement. They know the areas. They are part of the community. Look, Governor Perry's resources, he's allowed to use them in this fashion, and governors have done it in the past. It is very, very risky because National Guard are trained for wars. This is not a war. This is not a war on immigration. This is not a war at our border. This is a refugee crisis.
Speaking of the border, can we just stay there for one second? I'm embarrassed that I even have to ask this question. Marjorie mentioned the exploding numbers. Every estimate I've read says roughly 60,000 kids, the vast majority of whom unaccompanied. And by the end of September, what is this, July, August?
Yeah.
Two more months, there'll be 30,000 more.
More.
What is the border like that would allow 30,000 more kids when we're finally focused on the issue?
Right.
I'm not saying whether they should or shouldn't cross the border, but what would allow 30,000 more to cross the border? What's it like there?
Okay, so this is... for people interested in immigration, try to get to the border because you have this idea that there's a line, right? And there's a Mexican police officer on one side and a U.S. police officer on the other. It does not work that way. We have 2,700 miles of southern border. It is porous. And as my old boss, Secretary Napolitano, used to say, you build me a 50-foot wall and I'll build you a 51-foot ladder. I mean, that is the challenge, is that it's more porous than we need it to be or that we want it to be. And the desire to come, I mean, it's a magnet. So it's the desire sometimes makes crossing the border easier than it should be. But here's, to your point, they're getting picked up. I mean, in other words, it's not like they're just getting into society. They are getting picked up. And this is the challenge this governor faces. This is a challenge that Obama faces, which is now we have unaccompanied minors in our custody. They get processed through HHS because they are unaccompanied minors. They have health issues, you know, security issues, all of these horrible things that that they have. And then we have a process to determine what to do with them. That process takes time, and that's why we're having this debate about whether we bring them here.
Before we talk about your one of your bosses and whether you support what the decision he's made, sort of as an outlier, that would be Deval Patrick. I want to talk about your former boss just for a second. Yeah. I don't know if you followed this. Was going to use the inappropriate word, this back and forth between the Washington Post and the press secretary for the president the other day. Washington Post writes a story, not exactly a right-wing rag, the Washington Post saying President Obama ignored all the warning signs here. It's not just the right wing saying, it's the Washington Post. The press secretary for the president says, oh, unnamed sources. And the Washington Post comes back, unnamed sources. First Lady of Honduras and Guatemala in 2012. United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, the president of the union representing whatever ICE stands for, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers. There have been a multitude of high-profile warnings. Why did the president choose to ignore this?
Well, we don't know. I mean, choosing to ignore it versus putting it in a priority lane. You know, this is a problem. When you're president, you got a lot of things that are incoming is probably what happened, which is essentially this is not yet a problem. I saw unaccompanied minor cases, years ago. These numbers are just significant. And mass migrations, let me just be clear, mass migrations are always a threat. So it may have been these warning signs were coming, but they were amidst all sorts of concerns about mass migrations, whether it's boats, you know, walking or whatever else. I mean, and we have plans to deal with them because at some stage they do become refugee crises. And as you know, part of it has to do with the nationality of the person coming over. If you're Cuban, you get certain rules. If you're from Honduras, you get certain rules. It's the tyranny of the inbox, you know. And in hindsight, yes.
Take your line.
Coming.
That's a great line, by the way. It really is a great line.
I have been in the world of the tyranny of the inbox.
That is a good line. The voice you're hearing is Juliet Kayyem. She is a Homeland Security expert, worked for Deval Patrick and Barack Obama. She also just ran for governor of the Democratic side. You know, Stephen Lynch, another Democrat, and he's not the only one. Other people have said this as well, that part of the problem here is that these coyotes that smuggle people over are spreading these ideas so they can make money, that if these unaccompanied children just get to the United States, that they will get to stay. And Republicans and Democrats like Lynch have blamed this on Obama because he's, you know, perceived to be softening up on young people coming over here because of the Dreamers thing and all that.
Right.
And so bottom line, how much of this is the fault of the president because these coyotes are able to twist this and tell lies?
Well, there's always been coyotes. I'll tell a story about my own immigrant family. So, and you can imagine how this factored into a security clearance. My mother was born in Lebanon, as were seven of her siblings. The other two were born in Havana, Cuba. Why is that? Because at that time, there were coyotes going to places like Lebanon saying, come to Havana. It will be really easy to get to the United States.
States.
I mean,
that's
great. This has been part, you know, America is a very attractive place. So part of it, there's always been these people, and that's why we need to focus on prosecuting these coyotes. The status of these children that are coming over is actually not because of the DREAM Act, because that only applies to people who are here and are, as you know from what I've said before, are essentially American, but for the fact they, you know, their parents, you know, brought them over when they were one. It actually has to do with legislation passed bipartisan legislation that gives these kids special status and an ability to make their case. Look, we are now seeing the numbers decline. This is when, you know, Vice President Biden goes down there, talks to these countries. The fact that these kids do not have special status is clearly percolating down there to stem the flow. But I, you know, this is a refugee crisis, a moral crisis, and we have to help. I mean, there's just no, I mean, we could look back and say we should have seen the signs, but right now we need to stem the flow, and then we need to figure out what to do with these children.
So you answered the next question. Obviously, you support the governor's pronouncements that we all understand what strangers in a strange land are about. And by the way, the governor will be with us tomorrow, noon to one, and if you have a question for him about that, you can ask him directly. Should we trust the representation that's being made by the feds and our state government that the feds are going to pick up the whole tab here? I mean, we've talked a lot about this on the show. A decent amount of the either an email or calls of objection to this is not because people are uncaring or whatever. They're worried about who's going to pick up the bill. Can we trust the federal government to pick up the bill?
Because the way when look, this has happened before in both mass migration and refugee crises, although and even victims of Hurricane Katrina, because these kids are within the federal system, they go, they come over the border, they get picked up by ICE, they are processed by HHS, and they are likely to be held in military facilities. All of that is owned and paid for by the feds. So I can understand people's concern about these military bases being utilized. If you visit these military bases, as I have, you know, they're pretty isolated, and those communities benefit from their presence there. This is a short-term solution. No one should think that the dynamics of their communities will change significantly. It's not like the kids are being brought here and they're going to just, you know, go wherever they want. And I hate to say this, they're essentially in a form of confinement, and we just need the bases to make it as humanitarian as possible as they go through the immigration process. But I can understand the concern, and as the details come from the feds, it will be very helpful to hear those issues. But to me, this is absolutely essential that the state does, and I can understand people's concerns, but it is something that we need to do. If we don't do it, who are we? I mean, I honestly believe that.
That's the voice of Juliet Kyan. Let's move on to another topic. Yes. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. Right. People recall he was released over Memorial Day weekend. He'd been held in Afghanistan as a prisoner, and there was a lot of big photo op, the president and all that. Story didn't turn out so well when there were accusations.
With his parents.
Right. Exactly. That he had abandoned his post, et cetera. Yeah. So now, I mean, he's released on Memorial Day weekend. I don't think he's even seen his parents yet.
No, he refuses.
No, it's a very...
Yes. And he's back on active duty.
Yes. Exactly. He's back on active duty. Yeah. And you say, wow.
What the heck? Yeah.
Is he ready for active duty?
Well, he's at a desk job, so let's just be clear. So, and he is represented by the person who is clearly the best military lawyer, military law lawyer, a guy named Eugene Fidel. There's a joke about military justice. Military justice is to justice as military music is to music. But he is going to be well represented. And so let me just tell you. So the government needs to keep him in a military position because the rules of engagement, the rules of interrogation, the rules of interviewing, the rules of evidence are different in the military justice system. And so keeping him as our own within the military is probably the right thing to do, given, as you said, the story is so freaking complicated. And I will say...
This is so bad for his parents.
I know, but look on the outside. Look, if... Because I don't believe half of what we've read about him. I mean, this sounds like a case of abandonment. It sounds like a guy who clearly shouldn't have been in the military in the first place.
Right.
I think we're going to learn a lot about recruitment. And did we lower our standards because we were so desperate to get people in the military? We're going to learn something about the chain of command. Did they know about his mental issues? I think there's a lot to learn. So I kind of prefer it being in the military because then, hopefully there's going to be an accounting. It's not just about him. Something like this doesn't happen without there being signs and signals. And so he's at a desk job, too. I don't think he's armed. But it's a really bizarre story, and I think we should just all reserve judgment because I think there's a bigger story to tell here.
Excuse me, this is America. Reserving judgment? What is wrong?
I'm trying.
Immature position. And get the facts. Is that what you're going to say
I'm
next?
I'm trying like one, you know, one radio program at a time. You know, I mean, you know, having been a candidate, you know I know. I should have known better.
Well, let's move on to something else because we do have time to talk about that. More cities are making it illegal to be homeless, even as the availability of housing for the poor is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
Yeah, this is a movement amongst all these urban communities for two reasons. I mean, one is gentrification, and this is an amazing thing about the Democrats, demographics of this country right now. As younger people decide to stay in cities and as older people, empty nesters, decide, why the heck do I need this 2,000-square-foot house in the suburbs with a 60-minute commute, move into the city? The demographics of cities are becoming very, very dynamic, as we see even in this city, which means a lot of homeless people is not good politics. And it's horrible because at the same time, we're now completely dependent on nonprofits and non-governmental organizations to care for the homeless. And this is being pushed in both Democratic cities and Republican cities that you criminalize homelessness. And I have long thought that our criminal justice system has become too much, and Democrats are, as much as Republicans are to blame for this, too much the answer to all of our social ills. The idea that this is going to curb homelessness by putting people in jail.
And what this is the concern, ridiculous. I remember, this may harken back to, and I choose not to think about it much, my 2 years on the Cambridge City Council. I think it was there, but it may have been after that.
That's the first time we met. You knocked at my door. Do you remember that?
I can't believe, I do
on
remember
Regent
that.
Street, yeah.
Yeah, there's a story attached to that. That's a whole other story. Did you vote for me or not?
I think I did because you're the only one who knocked on my door.
Okay, well, that's good enough
but
for
yeah,
me.
No,
very persistent
I have no
guy.
Idea what the guy stands for, but I do know he knocked on my door. Hey, but is this because – well, I assume there are two motivators. One, what you said.
Yeah.
I think where you're going is – you hear what I started to say. I heard on the Cambridge – you know, I don't want to have to step over a homeless person in Harvard Square. And when I first heard it, I'm saying, what?
Yeah.
How do you think they feel lying there for you to step – but the second thing is – when politicians of all political stripes, I'm glad you said that, can't resolve a problem, they do something like this.
Yeah,
we can't figure out what to deal with homelessness, so let's jail them.
Right.
And
so
is that not what part of the
totally
deal is?
It totally is. I mean, we won't solve the low-income housing problem. We won't deal with mental health issues. We won't. And so let's just criminalize the behavior. The goal is, of course, to move these people will, you know, move, whatever that means, outside of city centers, make the city centers more attractive. To who? Developers. It's the developers who are demanding it. I mean, it is
here, though. I haven't heard this here in Boston or Cambridge.
I don't think we have the criminalization. It's just
a nationwide thing.
I reserve judgment. I don't know actually what's going on in each of the legislatures, but it is a nationwide phenomenon, and it's consistent. It is this country is changing. People are moving back to cities. That's both exciting, but it's going to have a lot of stresses on the urban environment for some time, whether it's transportation or housing or homelessness.
Well, Juliet Kahn, great to talk to you.
I know.
Thank you
so much.
I'm not
done yet. I need another second.
Oh, you do? Okay.
You do.
Do you remember the commitment I made to you when I asked for your vote? Was it 1999? Do you remember what I said to you? I remember like it was yesterday.
Really? What did you say?
She said to me, and talk about prescient.
You made
Juliet
a big Kayyem, impression, Jim.
Juliet Kayyem,
I was home on maternity leave.
Juliet
I remember
Kayyem
that.
Says to me, she says, here's the deal. If you ever have a radio show, I wasn't even in the meeting. Is that amazing? I mean, the vision of this woman is
and
really,
wow. And do you remember what I said to you?
No.
If I ever run for governor, I want you to have me on your show.
I remember that like it was yesterday.
We were like, you know, exactly. it was like we knew how the decades would unfold.
You know what I said
Did
to
you
the
have
guy
your
we're
newborn?
With? I said, that's never going to happen. So sure, I'll be happy to...
Sorry, did you have your newborn babe in arms?
No, if it was 1999, we had just moved here. I think you probably were my first vote. So you should. I mean, this is
it meant
this
a lot
is
to
epic.
Me, Juliet. I want you to know. Really
had, did you? Was it a route?
It wasn't a route. I made it, and the route was serving. Was the route? That's another story, Juliet. It's great to see you. See you
see
again
you later.
Next week,
Juliet Kayyem. Thank you for being with us. Juliet Kayyem ran for governor. She's also a former Homeland Security official who worked in both President Obama and Governor Deval Patrick's administration. Thanks for being here again, Julia. And up next, it is a mix of jazz, alternative rock, and classical music. Our concert roundup is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. It's time for our concert roundtable, which we aim to do roughly every 6 weeks. Here with us in Studio 3 are Rob Hochschild. He's Director of Communications for Berklee College of Music. How are you, Rob? Oh, I'm sorry. Rob Rob is not here yet. We'll say hello
He's
to
not
Rob.
Here.
In a
We're
moments.
A concert square table.
Look,
yeah. Concert square table.
Exactly.
Stuck in traffic.
Here. Brian McCreath. Yes, he is here. Brian McCreath is host with 99.5 WCRB and a producer, of course, of the Boston Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast. And Edgar B. Herwick III also made it. He's the man behind WGBH's Curiosity Desk. Gentlemen, good to see you both.
Good to be here.
Happy
Rob
to be
is
here.
On his way, by the way.
We,
he will
we
be
both
where,
had an easier commute,
stuck
in fairness, than Rob did. You came from down the hall. I came from upstairs.
Okay. Well, we'll start with you. Who wants to start here? Brian or okay, Brian
oh, well,
is going to
okay.
begin. Take
I'm
it away,
take you,
Brian.
I'm going to take you into a little bit of my own past. As we've talked about
great.
Before, you know, I was a trumpet player in a former life,
yes.
and I made my living that way. And one of the ways I made my living for a couple of years was with this orchestra in Mexico, outside Mexico City. Town called Toluca. Yeah,
wow.
This was great. This was the State of Mexico Symphony Orchestra. And it was conducted at the time, it still is actually, by Enrique Batis. He's a pretty well-known conductor. And so there I was, living in the highlands of Mexico, you know, playing for crowds. I'll tell you that Mexico has some of the most enthusiastic classical music crowds
really?
You can imagine. We would do these Tchaikovsky series and Beethoven series, and I'm not kidding when I say that there were teenage girls asking for my autograph afterwards.
Groupies. You had groupies.
I had groupies.
You had classical
everybody
music
Everybody in the orchestra had groupies.
Which wow. instrument has the most, like, is it like, you know, do the trumpet players, are the trumpet players like the
yeah.
ones?
Yeah, come on, Edgar. Yeah.
Says the trumpet player. Meanwhile, there's a French horn player in his car saying,
not at
now,
all.
I know you are a happily married man. Now, your wife is not one of those groupies, is she? Or is she?
Well, she is a groupie, but not from there. So
really?
That's a different story entirely. I did meet my wife while I was living in Mexico, but we met in Colorado, and we'll just have to have another show about
Fine,
that.
We
okay.
Will.
Okay, but so one of the composers that I really got to know and love in Mexico is a fellow by the name Silvestre Revueltas. He was a composer from the mid-20th century and was really a visionary. And we never hear about him, but he was just about as much of a visionary as Igor Stravinsky. I bring up Silvestre Revueltas because he is going to be featured in this piece called La Noche de los Mayos tonight. On the Esplanade with the Landmarks Orchestra.
Oh,
yeah.
Great.
So the Landmarks Orchestra, as you may know, does a series of free concerts on the Esplanade every summer. And that's what I'd like to talk about first, because it is just a fantastic way to spend a summer's evening. And the orchestra is sounding terrific these days. Christopher Wilkins is their conductor. It's the vision of Charles Ansbacher, who wanted free music for everybody. That was his whole mission in life. And that's why Landmarks Orchestra exists. And that's why they do concerts on the Esplanade. Their concert tonight is called Fiesta Sinfónica. It features La Noche de los Mayas by Silvestre Revueltas. But it also features some pretty cool music by a composer we know better than that. And that's George Gershwin. Take a listen to some of what they're going to play tonight. Oh, but we're getting to it. Here comes. Here comes. That's right. You're feeling good. So back when Cuba was a place you'd want to go visit for some fun, George Gershwin went there, and he thought, this is great. I'm going to write an overture. This is Cuban Overture by George Gershwin. It's going to be on the program tonight with Landmarks Orchestra, along with this piece by Silvestre Revueltas and some other music from South America and Mexico. And it's going to be just a really wonderful summer evening. Kathy Fuller from 99.5 WCRB is going to be a host, an MC for this concert. So that's fun, too.
Are these free concerts?
They're
or
free.
That's
you show up
that's
with
awesome.
A blanket
what a night.
On the Esplanade.
Oh,
how
beautiful.
Well do
what
they tend to be
night.
Attended? Like, when you go there, is there like a big crowd of people, total mix, families, old, young?
Yeah. I've been down there for these concerts before as well. And that whole sort of circle area right in front of the hat shell is filled with people.
Yeah.
And there's kids running around, and there's families, and there's a few people up front who are really, you know, there because they want to hear this music. And a lot of people, though, are just enjoying the atmosphere.
Yes.
You know, you're right there.
On the
Cambridge
water.
Cambridge is across the river.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, you forgot that Keith Lockhart is selling hot dogs tonight, which is really that
different orchestra.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Okay, that was a terrific
story. This is just a quick aside. It is amazing to me that they can have these huge concerts on the Esplanade, and the traffic on Storrow Drive generally is not bad. It's a little bit slower, but it's not really effective.
It's a little slower. And these go on throughout the summer. So there's Wednesday night concerts all through the end of August. They include other performances.
And you can park there.
You can park down there in the back bay.
It's great.
You just walk across the Arthur Fiedler Bridge.
Uh-huh.
And
or on Storrow Drive. They let you park on Storrow Drive sometimes.
So, lots of things going on every Wednesday night. Free concerts on the Esplanade. Landmarks Orchestra.
Sounds terrific. Edgar B. Herwick III, you're up.
Good stuff. All right, so we're going to go not quite as old as Gershwin, but but fairly old at this point. Let's start off with a song. I want to see if the gang here and if you, listener, dear listener, remember this worldwide hit.
Please lock me away.
So that is the sounds of Peter and Gordon.
They're not still alive, are they?
Well, Gordon is dead. Peter Asher is still alive. And he's playing tomorrow night at Johnny D's in Somerville.
Oh, my God.
Okay? That's pretty great.
Oh, my God.
So that song, like a number of their hits, was penned by Paul McCartney. Peter Asher was Jane Asher's brother. Jane Asher was
Paul McCartney's
girlfriend.
From
England, right? And so this is pretty cool. One of the interesting things about Peter from Peter and Gordon is that after Peter and Gordon, he had a huge career in music. He produced albums for James Taylor, which he won Grammys for. He produced albums for Neil Diamond, Steve Martin, Morrissey.
Wow.
He was, I think, a road manager for Carole King. And he was just like in the world, swinging 60s. You know, he was a guy with some money. He had international success with music. He was really good friends with Paul McCartney. So this show that he's doing, which he's been doing for about a year and a half now, is not just music. It sort of features the music of Peter and Gordon, and he has a backing band. But he brings along all of his personal video, personal photos.
This is great.
It's a whole multimedia presentation. He tells stories about John Lennon and Paul McCartney, Marianne Faithfull, Yoko Ono, you know, the whole nine yards. And apparently he's very charming. His stories are really good, and he plays some of the Peter and Gordon music and some other stuff, engages the audience, shows you his own personal photos and video. And that's all happening at Johnny D's, which is a pretty small venue for something like that in Somerville. And that's tomorrow night.
I have a very important question.
Yes.
What did happen to Jane and Paul? I know he married Linda McCartney, but do we know what happened? And does Peter still like Paul after the breakup?
That's a really good question.
Excellent question.
I think they are still friends. I'm not sure about it.
I don't know what happened.
The Curiosity Desk will dig into that.
You know what I'm going to do? I am not going to embarrass myself and admit that I know every word to World Without Love.
Now, it's a great song. I mean, it's a great single word.
Now, Rob Hochschild, obviously you chose to come late because you didn't want to hear what Edgar or Brian had to say, which is fine. I mean,
Brian,
that's
your
choice.
Step out of the room while
but
he
we
does
should say
stuff.
Your point. Boss, the president of your college, is joining us tomorrow morning.
Is that
so
right?
I would suggest you do well. Here's Rob Hochschild. He's director of communications for Berklee College of Music. Hello there, Rob.
Hello there, everyone. I am so sorry I'm late. You know, we have this thing at Berklee called Berklee Time. Everybody is about 10 minutes late for everything. So
it's live radio.
That's very jazzy of you.
That's
good.
Yeah, yeah. Just enough for jazz.
Yeah.
So I sprinted
behind
all the way.
Well,
okay, what do you got for us?
What we got is a free outdoor concert in the city happening a week from Sunday in one of these venues that I bet a lot of people haven't been to in the Fort Hill section up by that monument behind Roxbury Community College. It's really a great view of the city. What we're getting is actually somebody from our hometown of Philadelphia, a guy named Jaleel Shaw. And he's
by the way, when he says our, that would be three of us of five in the studio.
Yeah, that's so true.
That is me, Edgar, and Rob. Go ahead, Rob.
We don't care where anybody else is. No, that's not true. I'm sorry. Anyway, so Jaleel's from Philly. He's in his mid-30s. Great saxophonist. Established himself as a sideman after going to Berklee down in New York. He played with a big band. Lately, more of a band leader on his own. So he's playing this free show. It is the Jazz at the Ford concert. His sound on alto goes from very muscular to really beautiful. The alto sax can be a hard instrument to get a really pretty sound on. And he's got that down. So we're going to listen to the tail end of a tune called Wheel of Life from his most recent album. Now, the reason I picked this part of the tune is because there's this nice improvisatory section at the end of the tune, right after he stated the melody there, where just all this, like, group crazy stuff happens that's kind of cool. Just check it out. So a little bit of a controlled Coltrane-esque thing happening. This is going to be a great show. Sunday, August 3rd, 5 o'clock, Highland Park. It's part of Berkeley's collaboration with Boston Parks and
Is this a free deal,
Park.
Too?
It is totally free, yes.
Wow. Great. Can you not just picture yourself sitting outside like that? Is that song just not the exact kind of jazz you want to hear outside on a summer day, like a summer evening, wind going nice and easy?
Yeah. And Fort Hill's one of those little hidden away neighborhoods with with beautiful houses up there, too.
So true, yeah.
So, Rob, you have partially atoned for being late. Now we're back.
Thank you, Jim.
It's okay. I mean, partially. We'll see how you do in the next round. Round two begins back with Brian McCreath. Hey there, Brian.
Hey. So what we're going to do is head to Cape Cod, because that's where a lot of people head during these months.
Good point.
And the Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival is getting going. And the Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival has been around for a long time, but the two guys who run it now are two fellows named John. John Manassi, John Nakamatsu. Nakamatsu's a pianist, Manassi's a clarinetist. And so it's not them for the entire 2 months, but they are the artistic directors. But they're going to be giving a concert on July 27th in Yarmouth. And what I like about John and John, and they've been here in our studio before, is that they just are two of the most hysterical guys when they get together. It's that kind of chemistry, you know, that you when you have partners that work together and they just totally click, they find such a great balance at the Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival between that kind of atmosphere you want in a classical music concert that allows you to absorb music and really experience this music by these composers, but then also to have some fun along the way and to really kind of laugh at things and just be very laid back about it. So what I wanted to play, just to give you a taste of what John and John are up to, is a little part of a show that they did when they were here in our studio. And this is a piece that was written for them by John Novacek. It's called Four Rags for Two Johns. And here is the here's a little part of it called Schenectady. It harkens back to that Joplin rag.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
But if you listen,
but it's lighter.
There's a little bit of a twist to it with some more up-to-date harmonies, right? So this is not actually music they're going to play on this July 27th concert, but they are going to be doing a brand
such
new
a
I know,
this
such
amazing
a
song you will not hear.
That's right. There's something
well, I'm not going then.
But you will hear a brand new piece by a fellow named Goodwin, who has written four views for clarinet and piano. And then there's also some Paquito de Rivera along with Antony Dvorak. So it's that kind of feel. It's that kind of like smashing some things together that you don't necessarily expect with these two guys who are just terrific collaborators, really funny together. So that's the Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival. They're running from July 27th through, just several weeks of concerts all across Cape Cod, in Cotuit and Provincetown and Dennis and Wellfleet, everywhere.
I love clarinet solos. You don't hear them that much either.
No, you don't.
Them.
Clarinet's a great instrument.
It is a great instrument.
Yeah, Edgar, since you're allegedly, I just thought of this. I don't know why. Since you're arguably the best dancer at WGBH in the whole building, everybody says.
Oh, my goodness.
Have you seen the video?
Lindy
Hop. Have you seen the video of the two little kids, I think from Jersey, doing salsa dancing, and they're maybe 6 or 7 years old?
Can we get that on our web? Let's get that on our Facebook page, our website.
You have never seen anything like this in your life.
I will check it out.
I'm sorry, just leave it there.
No, that's okay.
In any case,
have you seen the 90-plus-year-old man on the dance floor?
With the canes.
Everybody should go look this up. He's got two canes. He's on the dance floor. He gets about 30 seconds in, and he ditches the canes, and he's freaking out. He's just like dancing.
Wow.
It is inspiring.
That is terrific.
Inspiring.
Okay. What do you got to inspire us, Edgar?
All right, well, we're going to turn the volume up now. It's summertime. We're going to get into some loud, raucous, punk rock type stuff. This is a band called Titus Andronicus, named after the Shakespeare character, Titus Andronicus. These guys are an interesting mix because, on the one hand, they're very serious. They're trying to deal with very, very big issues, and they seem like very serious, passionate people. But their songs are very big and loud and almost desperate. They come from New Jersey, and
explains it.
It does, but they talk a lot about the spirit of Bruce Springsteen, especially early Springsteen, and that idea of that like passion that you have and that like feeling of like I just need to like get out of my own skin somehow and into a bigger world. And these guys are not the best musicians. The singer is not the best singer that you've ever heard, but I've seen them live a couple of times, and their presence on the stage and the commitment and the insanity that ensues is so big and so infectious that whenever they're in town, I recommend going and seeing these guys. So let's hear a little bit of a track from their latest record, which is called Upon Viewing Oregon's Landscape with the Flood of Detritus. I mean, this is real roll down the window, tap your hands on the steering wheel music, and every track is like this. I mean,
don't
they
you sort
are
of
big.
Feel, even if you've never seen them, that you know exactly what they look like
yep.
on the stage?
Totally.
I mean, they
totally.
Really project an image for their music that's great.
Yeah, these guys are great. So they're playing August 26th at the Middle East. Definitely worth checking out. It's going to be a great show, I suspect.
Okay, Rob Potion, you got something going on at the Regatta Bar.
We do, yes. It's a local group called Grand Fatilla, and they describe themselves as a world jazz folk ensemble. Two members are from Italy, two are North Americans, and the bassist actually is Mike Rivard, who some people know from a group called Club Delft that plays at the Lizard Lounge regularly. So these four guys, four dudes with gigantic ears, like the music of the world is their palate, metaphorically speaking, gigantic
okay.
ears.
Audrey,
so
look at your face.
Their
it's like,
ears are enormous.
Yeah, like 10 feet high.
Barack Obama was thinking of joining
yeah,
the group.
Yeah, yeah. He actually auditioned, but, you know, his mandolin skills weren't quite there. Anyway, so they have a very global interest in music. You'll hear in their work music that comes from Argentina, Turkey, Ireland, Morocco, Bulgaria, Italy, obviously.
Can you just list the countries that they're not influenced
yeah,
by?
It's... I can't think of it now.
Angora.
Yeah, yeah that's the
nothing
one.
Nothing from Angora.
So we're going to list, and suitably, their new CD is called Global Shuffle. So we're going to listen to a tune from that called Domeni. It's a Roberto Cassan composition. I love what they're doing in the middle of this tune as they come out of this improv and go back to an arrangement. Let's listen to a little bit of this. So it's almost got this flowing sound, and you can hear these multi-influences yeah. all at the same time. Mandolin in there, and bass, accordion.
I was gonna say,
really interesting instrumentation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these guys have their... there's that accordion coming in there. They have their big first CD coming out on September 4th, Regatta Bar. That's their CD release party. And I think it's really going to be an interesting night. I've seen them at the Beat Hotel in Harvard Square. Which
so,
is
Rob
kind of Hosh,
before
nice.
We move yeah. back to Brian, I just want to be clear. Clearly, I was mistaken. Big ears did not mean big ears in a literal
right.
sense.
Well,
but now, so is this the cool musical jazz term for if you have what? Big what?
Yeah, well, it means you hear really well, you're a good listener, you're
yeah.
a sympathetic musician, you can take in everything and find your place in the music really smoothly. And
it's not even just jazz players that say that.
Right.
You say that, I mean, actually, just that brings up something that happened over the weekend with me, that Tanglewood, as we were producing the Boston Symphony concerts this last weekend, who should show up backstage but Gunther Schuller?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
Anytime
Jeez.
You say Gunther Schuller, the first thing that pops in my mind is, that guy's got big
yeah.
ears.
He literally
I mean, he's
has,
like,
and
his,
he actually does also have
well,
big ears.
But it's the kind of person that can hear anything. They can hear when something is out of tune. They can hear
okay.
through dense textures to pinpoint one little detail that they want to change. That's big ears,
okay.
you know, when you can just absorb everything that's coming at you in an auditory way and dissect it instantly.
Is that something that tends to be a gift from the gods, or is it something that people really work hard to develop, or it's probably a combination of the two,
right? I think it's a combination.
Right?
I mean, I think that for Gunther, I think it's a gift. I think Gunther
yeah.
is a phenomenon, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Gunther Schuller, if you're not aware, I mean, he is one of the all-time sort of legendary American composers of our last, you know, 60 years, and basically kind of invented this way that he called third stream of combining classical music and jazz and now it's called more of contemporary improvisatory music, whatever you want. But Gunther Schuller is a genius who started playing in the Metropolitan Opera, playing French horn when he was 15 years old.
Wow.
And so seeing him was just a great thing.
But he didn't
anyway.
Have groupies, Brian.
He didn't have groupies. Actually, I wasn't so sure about that because this guy hung with Miles. And he hung out with everybody in jazz. He would end his performances at the Met, and he would go down to the Village and sit in on jazz sessions with his
but
French
don't
horn.
Don't you have that's the so big cool. cheeks with the French horn?
Oh, that's you're thinking of Dizzy Gillespie.
That's a trumpet thing, too.
Yeah,
isn't
Dizzy was a trumpet player.
Every time I see someone play the French horn, it's like their face going to
blow.
It's
a hard, it's a great look. It's a hard instrument to play.
I'm not sure it gets the groupies going.
Probably not.
Yeah,
to each his own. Okay, so, Brian McCreese.
All right, but there's no French horns involved in this next thing. So what I was just delighted to find out is that there's a brand new music festival that's just getting started called the Halcyon Festival, and it's basically based in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. A couple of other little towns in New Hampshire that they go to. But if you're up on the North Shore, you might be within striking distance of the Portsmouth and so you can get to the Halcyon Music Festival. What struck me about this festival is that are the people involved. So Heng Jin Park, who is one of the pianists in Boston that does great work everywhere, she's the one who's sort of behind this. And she's gathered up a lot of other great players, including Irina Murashanu. She is a world-class violinist who just plays with all this passion. She teaches at Boston Conservatory and plays with all kinds of groups around town. Jan Müller-Scherofs is a cellist who has played with everybody in town and is just a very passionate cellist on his own. So they're getting started with their very first concerts on the 24th of July, which is tomorrow. And then they're going to be running through August 2nd. In their very first season. What I wanted to play to sort of highlight their work is part of the work that they're going to play on July 26th. And this is a piece called by Arnold Schoenberg called Transfigured Night. Let's just listen to a little bit of it first. It's for string sextet. And when you hear the name Arnold Schoenberg, sometimes people get a little worried because he was the person who came up with atonal music and 12-tone music, which to a lot of people makes no sense whatsoever at all. But in this case, this is not atonal. This is, I mean, we can barely hear, you kind of have to hear the entire thing to get the trajectory, but this is a musical depiction of a poem by Richard Damel that describes the story of a man and a woman walking at night. The woman confesses she's been unfaithful. She's going to have a child by another man. And it's their conversation through this entire walk, through this poem, that is tumultuous. They wrestle kind of verbally with each other, and eventually they come to peace with each other. So it's this incredible emotional experience that Schoenberg was depicting. And so that's one of the pieces that's going to be done on July 26th with the Halcyon Festival in New Hampshire.
Are you happy, Marjorie? It's just, she is transported by this whole... Edgar.
This is why I hate following Brian. It's like, man, based on a poem about...
I gave you a clarinet rag last time,
yeah,
okay?
It's true. That's it's true. You've been fair up until that point.
Go ahead,
you
Edgar.
Jerk. All right, so I'm gonna look a couple of weeks out to a concert that's happening in September at Royale. And this is a group called Shovels and Rope, which is a duo. They're big enough at this point that they're going to do two nights, September 26th and 27th. The last time they were in town, they sold out pretty quickly. Anyway, these guys are they're a husband and wife duo from the American South. And they both kind of had middling solo careers for a while. And a few years ago, they'd come across each other on tour, whatever. They started getting together, and they made a decision: let's kind of abandon our solo careers and try to do something together. They put out a record, and this song that I'm going to play you got a lot of play last year on this record. Made it to a lot of critics' top 20 lists.
Yeah.
The song made it to a lot of top 10 lists for Song of the Year. And it's really an autobiographical or semi-autobiographical story about this decision that they made to kind of get together. And so, you know, they tried to put, you know, everything of their sound into this. And they are, you know, kind of one of these groups that is this combination of blues and country and gospel and soul with a little bit of a modern feel, that there are a number of groups kind of working in this kind of palette right now that are really good. But these guys are particularly good. Let's hear this track, Birmingham, from Shovels and Rope. Georgia on a Friday night, saw that little girl, she could sing all right.
By the way, waiting for that little girl to come around, the backstory is Shovels had a baby with Peter Asher and he's dragging it to rope. But it's a very sad
but
tale.
It was a long walk email, one night when they talked it all out.
Jane broke up with Paul because she didn't want to be a housewife. Whatever. That's what the email said. So
really? Rob, you have a all minute right. left yeah. and we're going to go out on your music. So
all right,
take
well,
it away.
I have no story to tell here about these guys. They're just great musicians, a group of musicians that came together at the University of North Texas called Snarky Puppy.
You don't need a story with that name.
That's right. And they're one of many, many bands playing at the Newport Jazz Festival. These guys, which is in early August, these guys are playing on Friday, August 1st. It's like funk, jazz fusion, jam band, metal-ish stuff in there, a little bit of everything. This song is called What About Me? They have a lot of arrangements. There's all these movements to their music, and this tune in particular, just really slamming hard grooves and just cool music that cuts across.
I love that. It's that line. They do this in North Texas a lot. They find that line in big band and rock and yeah. some grit. They just yep. throw some yeah. grit in there, and yeah. it's just really cool stuff.
Newport Jazz Festival is still a neat thing.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Just checking.
Definitely.
Just
lots
checking.
Of great musicians there this year, and you got, including one of Brian's favorites, Trombone Shorty.
Trombone Shorty.
Gary Burton, Bobby McFerrin, Wynton Marsalis. So that's always great.
Okay, you guys, as always, thanks for so much for coming in. Brian McCreeve, host of 99.5 WCRB, also the producer for the Boston Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast. Rob Hochschild is director of communications at Berklee College of Music, and Edgar B. Herrick III runs WGBH's Curiosity Desk. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we have Ask the Governor, so tune in for that. Thanks to our promotions team, production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roosevelt, Amanda McGowan, Devin Karambulis, our intern, John and Alan Mattis, our engineers. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow.